Welcome to Cypherpunk Bitstream 0x0e Culture Corruption. My name is Frank and with me today here is...
Smuggler, hello.
Hi Smuggler, how are you doing?
I'm doing according to circumstances, how are you?
That's a very neutral answer. Same for me.
Yeah, I made the big mistake to spend some time looking at the code quality and stack of several messaging systems, and I'm highly frustrated.
What did you find out?
It's the enormous amount of dependencies, bugs that haven't been fixed for ever. Most of the stuff is not distributable, federated, whatever. Crypto is lacking when it comes to real attackers, in my opinion. So I don't know. I'm looking for an ideal that clearly doesn't exist.
The ideal messenger.
The ideal messenger.
So that you can host yourself and it's just super secure and not built on a hipster stack.
Exactly. So yeah, that was the frustrating stuff of today. So I don't know. But I'm not going to fix that because that's so much work, and I'll just hope and cross my fingers that some of the projects really advance and focus mostly on the code quality and protocol and not on bling bling and icons and emoticons and whatever.
Yeah, it looks like everybody's working on the UI level right now. Adding stickers and threads and emojis and reactions.
I mean, the thing is, my required features are relatively small. I mean, I want end-to-end encryption with perfect forward secrecy. That would be nice. And I want to be able to have small groups of maybe up to 50 people maximum. And I want to be able to send files. That's it. You know, no bling bling, no reactions, no typing indication, all these things. I really don't care. I just want secure end-to-end messaging that is stable, that I can host myself, and that is federated. That's all. But apparently, only me wants that, so nobody codes this. And I'm not going to, so I'll stop complaining.
And Matrix self-hosting is also not easy.
Matrix self-hosting is okay, but it's missing a critical feature for me. And that is, I would really, really love disappearing messages or something similar. So... plus the, you know, all of these things have these 100 million dependencies. And I really hate that. I mean, they're making good progress on actually implementing a Go-based server that only has one dependency, which is Postgres. So I can probably live with that. But I don't know. Apparently, the market wants very different things than I do. And the market is always right, as you know, so.
Well, yeah. I'm not sure if it's the market that wants it. I think it's just also, it's how software is developed. You know, it's very easy to add a dependency, but it's very hard to stick with a project that keeps the amount of dependencies low.
Yeah, true. I mean, the problem with all these things is that the more dependencies you have, the more brittle it becomes. And then update paths become really problematic. So you basically push a lot of pressure into the future when you have to update your dependencies because of security or something like that. And then you have to hustle and stress yourself to get your system under control again. And that for every dependency you have. So I know. You know, in my ideal world, I would use one of those secure USB sticks, you know, those micro computers on USB. I forgot the name. What's the name?
USB Armory?
Yeah, a USB Armory. So a USB Armory with Tamago, Bare Metal Go, implementing the server. That would be awesome. You know, just stick into a network somewhere and forget about it. But we'll never get there. So.
We're in a bull market right now. Maybe you should launch some token and then get it financed.
Yeah, but I don't think that messengers and blockchain should have much to do with each other. So.
Yeah, probably not. No, it's not a right fit.
Yeah. So I'll continue to complain, but I will complain silently.
Like you said, it's disappearing messages are important and blockchains are not famous for stuff.
No, nothing disappears on the blockchain.
It's a different use case.
It is. It is. And how are you?
Yeah, pretty good, actually. It's a good day. Interesting times. Yeah, been reflecting a bit on the how life was, you know, a decade ago, and a lot has changed.
Less parties.
Yeah, I mean, no parties now, but less parties in general. If I zoom out, actually, it's pretty good.
Okay. So on personal level, good, and on global level, what about that?
Well, our alternative title was, what the fuck is going on?
So what the fuck is going on? What's the fuck that is going on?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to understand the situation. I mean, if you're not looking at 10 years, but if you're looking at, say, 2 years back, it's a very different situation now, you know, with this whole COVID thing changed a lot of things, I have the impression, and I'm afraid it's not going to revert. It's not going to be like revert back. It's not.
So what do you think is going to stick around that is negative?
Travel restrictions or making it harder to travel, you know, things like vaccination passports, for example.
Okay.
I think will become a thing.
Okay. I mean, for a lot of countries on this planet, that is already a given and has been a given before COVID. I mean, there are a lot of countries you cannot enter without having yellow fever vaccine. So.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, like in general, I mean, I never experienced that being checked. Probably also didn't travel to the countries where they check for yellow fever. But I mean, a lot of the things were not really enforced. But it seems to me that we're moving in to the direction where it's always, okay, you have to personally identify, you have to prove that you're vaccinated. It's a lot more tracking going on, just like through enforced regulation or through people thinking they have to enforce it. I mean, here, like, people want you to register if you buy a sit down to drink a coffee.
True, but is it really enforced? I mean, my feeling with a lot of these rules, at least from my experience both traveling and in the country, is that a lot of rules are on paper, but nobody really puts the effort into enforcing them. So they're like a billion other rules that we don't even know about because we've never seen them being enforced.
Mm.
I mean, sure, for air travel, you outsource the enforcement to the airlines. So that probably means that there will be something done there. But crossing borders by car, I didn't have any issues during the whole time of the pandemic so far. And when it comes to registering at restaurants, okay, maybe it's me just putting in bullshit data that is the bad solution, but those rules are made for breaking, I think, a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, sure, I think there is a difference between air travel and other travel. I think air travel will stay even more inconvenient than what it already was before. So I'm also trying to shift more to car travel.
And it's a nicer travel anyways. You know, you see the countryside, you interact with the people. you can curse at Italians. So
yeah, for long distance, I would like to have a driver, you know, that would be good.
I'm cheap to hire, you know, just 80 euros an hour, and I'll drive you anywhere.
Just 80 euros, okay.
No. But I have driving security training, so, you know, that's worth something.
Yeah, 80 is a bit too much, I'm afraid.
Well, okay. You'll have to look for a different driver then.
Then I sit in the back and make 80 bucks an hour to have you drive me. Programming.
Money flows in the correct direction, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So what else is changing that, like, in the last 2 or 10 years that concern you?
Well, I think we discussed this already a little bit on the podcast, is that I think it's generally people are like more divided and seem to be living in completely different realities. That's my impression. You know, you could see it with, let's say, US election, where basically, you know, Democrats and Republicans, they seem to live in different universes and have a totally different view on reality. And now you see it in the whole pandemic thing as well, you know. It's really, I find it really astonishing how, although we all live on the same planet, it seems like people are really have these completely different perceptions. And just probably due to social media, or accelerated by social media, you know, people live in their own bubbles, or in their own self-perpetuating belief systems, so to say.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's not even, I don't even want to say, you know, okay, I believe this or I believe that, but it is very concerning to me if, let's say, half of the population thinks there is a virus and half thinks there isn't, you know, as an example, or like what you saw in the election. That it's really like different planets.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about, you know, okay, there's some disagreement about some issue or how exactly should we react. It's like completely contradictory worldviews and but living in the same place.
Do you think that there's that these opinion groups that form, is there a clear dividing line, so to speak? People that believe in COVID also believe something else and believe something else, or is that divided by every single topic?
No, I think that there are like certain, let's say, clusters.
Okay. So in that kind of speaks for those beliefs not being generally rational, but that people hold those beliefs to belong to a group. You know what I mean? So if you have rational thinkers that just make mistakes, then you have no big clusters that hold multiple false or right beliefs. You know, because you make different mistakes and different topics, and then it's nicely chaotic and distributed. And I think that is what has usually been the case, that of course everybody has a certain chance to be wrong and to believe something that most people wouldn't believe, or that, you know, have a slight nudge in their values maybe, and then make different decisions when it comes to truth. But usually that means that there's a huge mixture of belief sets and not strong grouping across different beliefs. And so if you have this actual polarization in, let's say, 2 or 3 groups, then that speaks not for random error, but for a different source of where people get their beliefs from. And that can then mean that there's a complete disconnect in the sources that people consult, or it can be that they hold certain beliefs to to agree with their peers, because, you know, that's one of those things when it comes to a lot of so-called rational people or people that think that they're rational, is that in essence, we often aren't, even if we believe we are, because for humans, it is more important to be liked than to be right. And it is, we tend to believe what our friends believe, not because we select our friends by belief, but because we select our beliefs by friends. You understand what I'm saying? So
Yeah. I think that's part of the explanation. I mean, what you try to say first is that if everybody is looking at each issue independently and coming to a conclusion, and you know, sometimes the conclusions are wrong, then we would basically have like this random distribution, right, where people are, you know, just randomly disagreeing on certain issues. But that's not the case, right? We see clustering. I think we can agree on that. Of course, it's not perfectly clustered, but it's pretty strong clustering. And I think there are multiple reasons why that is happening. And I think what you mentioned is this belonging to a group is one of them. That you belong to, let's say you're part of a certain group or whatever philosophy movement, and then there is a certain tendency to agree with opinions that form there. I think that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another one is just also fashion.
What do you mean with fashion?
Well, like certain things, they become fashionable. You know, opinions or...
But that is the same thing as believing what your peer group says. So fashion is veering what your peer group considers to be fashionable. It's basically the same thing. The question is, with fashion is more like, what's the source? So the source of fashion is fashion opinion leaders, but the reason why it's important is still the peer group that follows that opinion leader.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, it is also, they probably interact with each other, you know, peer group and fashion. But sometimes things become fashionable that nobody was thinking about before. And then suddenly it's a big thing everywhere. Or, I mean, it's usually more in certain groups than in others, but there is some effect going on there. Let's say, you know, now everybody, you know, you can get gluten-free food everywhere. You know, now everybody's gluten intolerant and gluten-free food is this big thing. And like 10 years ago, there were still people who were like gluten intolerant, but it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't fashion. So now it's a thing. And, I mean, this is not a political opinion, of course, but I mean, there are these, you know, cycles where certain things become fashionable and, without any real, reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, okay, going back to crazy blockchain land, you know, let's say Dogecoin, right? It's clearly a total meme thing and still.
But it's up 40% today.
It's up.
It's a store of value.
It's up 200x in the last 6 months.
Clearly a store of value. It will replace Bitcoin one day.
Yeah, the flippening is happening.
Okay, we're joking.
It's not financial advice.
It's not financial advice and not actual opinion. It's just a joke, you know, before you all freak out.
But more seriously, I think what is also a strong driving factor in the clustering effect is the, let's say, predisposition. You know, like if you are, let's say, okay, you're libertarian, right? So why are you libertarian? Because, I mean, you reach that conclusion, or maybe it's also just some predisposition. You like freedom, you know. You don't like to be told what to do. Okay? And if you're that, then you're probably against forced lockdowns, or it's more likely that you're against forced lockdowns because of the predisposition. Not necessarily to conform to the group, but because of that, you know, certain say character traits. I think that is also a big driving factor there.
Funnily, so when it comes to a lot of these lockdown discussions and whatever, what I've noticed is that a lot of the anti-lockdown people are actual complete control freaks in other ways. So there's, for example, there's this correlation for anti-immigration, strong police, and being anti-lockdown. So it's this, it doesn't make sense in itself.
You mean it's like self-contradictory? Or?
It is to a certain degree self-contradictory. You cannot be both a control freak and not a control freak at the same time. You know, that doesn't make sense. And on the other side, it's the same thing. It's this, we're for lockdown, but we're also for less police, but higher taxes. These things don't really align well, in my opinion.
But I think we discussed this theory recently about why the left in the US is for lockdowns and why the right is against them, right?
Why is the left for lockdowns?
Wasn't it us talking about this? So basically the theory goes that COVID started and then Trump was against lockdowns.
True.
So the left had to be for lockdowns and then the Republicans had to be against them. And it's, in a way, it's the wrong way around, philosophically speaking. It should be the other way around, right? It should be the conservatives saying, okay, we have to protect the, you know, the country and, you know, have to be conservative here. And
well, they are conservative. They want to conserve the economy. So that is conservative.
Yeah, but the liberals should be for, you know, freedom of movement and things like that. So
true.
So I think that is also an effect often, you know, that when some group takes a position, the group who is against that position, against the group, automatically changes the other position just to be, you know,
true.
Contrarian.
True. It's the same thing with the wearing of masks. Everybody is freaking out about this. You have to wear masks, but it's probably the best thing that could happen to us when it comes to anti-video surveillance. But those people that are against video surveillance, apparently, you know, events being controlled by the state, being recognized everywhere, being in panic of Big Brother, it's the same people that refuse to wear a mask because now nobody can recognize me anymore. So it's another one of those opinions that in a larger context don't really make sense. And I think we have that for a myriad of things these days. So we have these clusters, and I actually think there are only like two big clusters. And in the middle, there's some flowing around people that change their opinion, etc. But in the end, I really think it's only those two groups. I'm not sure that liberal and conservative is really the right distinction there. Maybe it is. But as you say, there seems to be this, those two groups have to disagree on everything. That's like the default mode of whatever they do, is they have to disagree on everything.
Mm. Before we go into this, let me just add to the mask thing. I agree. I think that is actually one of the best things that happened through that. I mean, we will probably for 5, 10, if not 20 years, we will always have an excuse why we wear a mask. Always. You know, if somebody asks you, you just look at them and you just put on your hysteric voice and you say, because of the virus. You know, and they put you in the nutty bin, but it's fine. You know, it's going to be fine. Totally. You know, you can fully, you know, put gloves on and whatnot, you know, fully mask up and be like, it's going to be fine.
True. I mean, your response should be depending on what group the asking person is. So if it's a conservative, you can say it's because of Big Brother and I don't want to be surveilled by Silicon Valley and the progressives. And if it's a liberal, I can say it's because of the virus.
No, I mean, like in some, you know, sort of official capacity, I mean. Or like, let's say you're traveling somewhere or you're running through some city or something. And like 2 years ago, you know, it might have looked weird. And, you know, let's say some police guy might have asked you, okay, why are you, you know, masking up? And now it's...
I've never been asked by the police. Never. It's always random people that are concerned. It's never the police that is concerned. Except for protests. So the protests... That's the police that is concerned there.
Yeah. But even that, now you can kind of pull it off with...
Well, you cannot go to a protest without a mask anymore.
Which is also totally contradictory, right? They didn't repeal the law.
No, they didn't.
So you now have to wear a mask if you go to protest to protect yourself against, you know, to comply with...
Hygiene measures.
Yeah, and at the same time, you're not allowed to wear a mask. Didn't they pull the thing in Germany where they said, okay, you kind of have to wear a mask in a car, but at the same time, you're not allowed to mask up in a car because
not as a driver.
Not as a driver. So if you wear the mask, you cannot wear the sunglasses because then you're,
yes.
You know, some crazy shit like that.
Yeah.
So, but what do you think are these two groups then?
So there's this other big thing where everybody disagrees on, and that started before COVID, and that is the identity / culture wars. So we have these things that we call, you know, cancel culture and Me Too and new economic theory and all these things that...
You mean like the modern monetary theory?
Yeah, exactly. So there's this... Apparently all the pro-lockdown people and pro-mask people and all the Democrats and all the liberals and all the progressives and all the left seem to be great defenders of these culture and identity wars, while on the other side, whoever is left is rather critical of them. So that's another big field of opinion. So it's more than one opinion. So it's how it's called, multisectionality?
Intersectionality.
Intersectionality that divides those two groups as well. And what apparently is completely impossible by now is to talk with each other about any of those subjects, because you cannot actually agree just a little bit or disagree just a little bit. You have to be all in for one side. And on the other hand, it's a subject that is pushed into every aspect of life and society at every corner. And in a way, it's one of these big opinion fields that is dividing society. Especially because there's no real way of communicating over it.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's this combination, right? That it's the discussion is formed in a way, or is done in a way that there is no middle ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, you know, escalated to you're either this or that. You know, there is no room for disagreement in a way, and at the same time, it's like this: everything is political.
Yeah,
you kind of have to talk about it.
Yeah,
you know, this this idea, let's say, that you go to work and you don't have political discussions at work because, well, it's work, and you know, you have your political discussions and your ideas outside of work is almost, you know, radical these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of reminds me about what I read about, you know, socialism, that it's always political, you know, it's everywhere. Everything is like class struggle. And I think that it's going in a similar direction here, that it's always like this, but it's super important that we talk about these things at work, and also creates this. I think that's another thing that he set up, is like this: if you don't say something, you're complicit. You mm-hmm. people kind of try to force you into a position where you actually express an opinion.
Yeah.
And it's not okay to say, you know, okay, well, I don't really consider the issue and I'm not really interested in looking at it right now. So,
yeah, everybody is forced to make a judgment on these issues. So it's not that you can say, okay, I'm judgment free there, or I don't have enough information, or I don't care, or I have a complicated opinion. But it has to be this, you're either on our side or on the side of the others. And if you're on the side of your others, you're the enemy, you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So this being forced to judge is, in a way, there seems to be a meme or an idea out there that wants society to sort into those groups. You know what I mean?
Not exactly. No.
So some ideas are designed in a way that they are polarizing by themselves. So they are a sorting function. So the idea itself implies that you have to have an opinion and that depending on your opinion, you go into two different camps. And the whole idea set requires you to be aligned in all judgments. So, for example, there's this huge discussion in feminism, and I have no idea about feminism, but what I heard is this, you cannot be both a feminist and not support trans women in sport. So you have to take both of these things at the same time. You have to be pro trans in sports. So in their, you know, how you call it, expressed gender, chosen gender or whatever. And you can be a feminist, but you cannot differ on those two things. And if you do, everything falls apart. It's this whole, what's the name of this Harry Potter writer, Rowling's or something?
Yeah.
She got into so much trouble because her opinions there didn't align with the canon of orthodoxy, or the same thing with this Jenner person. It's like this person in the US running for Senate, I think, or for Congress. It's a trans woman, I think. And she doesn't agree that trans women should be allowed to play in women's sports. And now everything is breaking down on her because she doesn't subscribe to the complete orthodoxy.
Mm.
And that is what I meant with there are certain sets of ideas that are essentially designed to sort people into very confined groups, into exactly two groups. You all either buy the whole thing, cloth and everything, or you're out. So it's a certain extreme form of orthodoxy that you have designed into these idea complexes.
Hmm. But I'm not sure if it's really like the idea complexes or if it's just like a outspoken subgroup that is, you know, like the most orthodox, so to say, you know, who is attacking everybody who's not agreeing with it.
At least when it comes to the spokespeople that I have heard so far. So, for example, I had this podcast that I listened to in preparation where this American woman of color, strong feminist activist, she was listing all the bad things, you know, about the patriarchy. And the patriarchy was not just against women or trans or homophobia, whatever, but it also included things like capitalism. So there are a lot of these not connected subjects that are pulled into one explanatory frame, and you have to be against all of them. So apparently there's this not small movement, at least when it comes to media, that says, okay, if you're pro women rights, you also have to be against capitalism. And people are trying to combine all those issues together. And it is, for me, it is amazing how they can get away with that. For me, it is amazing how big these subjects are in media and in social media and in academia, even though they often lack a good analytical framework, even if they cannot actually demonstrate how these issues belong together. And they still get away with creating this whole complex of ideas that sorts society.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I mean, I already feel uncomfortable right now, you know? And the reason is that my my impression is that these issues are like so, what's the word, contentious? Contentious that if you just, you know, like we do now, you know, try to talk about it a little bit, try to grapple with it, you know, that it has like this risk that this, you know, shitstorm will come down on you, you know, that somebody picks up some quote, you know, out of context, or even if it's in context, doesn't matter. And then you're like, you know, attacked like without end, like this J.K. Rowling thing, you know, where basically somebody identifying as a feminist, but then she says the wrong thing in that cluster. And then she has like this complete shitstorm coming down on her that, I mean, I can understand why a lot of people say, okay, I don't even want to talk about this, especially not in public. I don't want to express any opinion because, the cost is just too high. You know, so that means all the moderate, I think a lot of the moderate people, like either, I think it's fine that you don't have an opinion on certain issues, you know, I mean, that's one thing, right? Because it's just maybe not your issue. It's not your thing.
Or you're just lacking information.
Yeah, you're lacking information. I mean,
yeah.
To be honest, what do I know about the problem of trans people? Not much. You know, it's not my problem. So I'm not an expert, or, you know, things like that, or whatever. You know, people who are Muslims, it's not my religion. So what do I know? You know, that's one thing. And the other thing is that, yeah, people don't want to engage with these things when they're, let's say, moderate. And they rather shut up because it's, in a way, I think it's the radicals, or the, in the sense that they have more extreme positions, that are the loudest. And that means that, you know, if you're more moderate or you don't have an opinion, I think people often just shut up, and that creates that impression that it's like really only these opinions that dominate. Although maybe the majority of people actually have a moderate position, but is afraid to even talk about it because they don't want to deal with the outrage, because it can pull like this, you know, this ton of energy from you if you do talk about it.
The thing that we already established is that there's this social environment pressure to talk about these things. So you have to have a judgment. And then, on the other hand, if you have the wrong judgment, the pressure of the accepted classes descends on you. So the interesting thing there is actually that if you look at the whole thing from like a mile away, you know, you just try to see the situation by itself, by the behavior of people. What I cannot help to think is that if you're living in the times of the Spanish Inquisition, you have the same thing. There's a certain orthodoxy that you have to confess to publicly. You cannot diverge from it because it would be bad or irrational, or because they might kill you. And the whole society is slowly molding into that thing that tries to preserve orthodoxy. So if you take away the content of the thing, you know, you take away So Spanish Inquisition, you have the Catholic religion, and now we have this, however you call it, you know, the progressive memeplex. But the both of these ideas and their social structure is that they become highly orthodox, like enforced orthodox. And you have people that have to confess that they believe in them just to be able to get on with their lives. And the moment you disagree with that, you're out. And I was told in school that we're past that point where liberal societies would insist on orthodoxies, that instead we would have a pluralism of opinions and have a competition of opinions and not a more or less forced way on what opinions you publicly proclaim. And who was this company in the Bitcoin field that has had this trouble with
Coinbase?
So if I get the story right, and please correct me if I don't, is they had discussions about similar issues internally. You know, they had people that were very politically active, that were spending their time with progressive activism, let's call it. And the company more or less said, okay, this is creating strife and it's distracting from work. And the company actually offered people to leave because they shouldn't waste the time of the company discussing those things.
Yeah, I think the big conflict there was that the employees wanted the company basically to make a political statement on that issue. And the company said, and then eventually they had discussion, I think, and then they eventually the head, I think, decided, okay, we're not going to make a political statement because that's basically out of scope, as we would say in software engineering, of the mission of the company. And then that kind of escalated. So they were trying to force the issue basically on the company. And then the company offered them to leave.
So, and that is what I mean, is this quasi cult-like, everybody has to confess to the orthodoxy or be bad situation.
Well, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. And but again, that is probably similar to the acquisition. I mean, what you just said about, you know, you have this idea of academia, let's say, being, you know, this space where you have open discussions and you have different opinions and we have like a free space. But now there's a lot of universities, before you even start, you basically have to do, you know, anti-racism training or anti, you know, unconscious bias training. But pretty much these things have been defined as outside of that space where you can discuss about things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they say, you know, racism is not an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's these things have been defined as wrong, and you first have to.
It's still an opinion. It's maybe the wrong opinion, but it's still an opinion. What else can it be?
But I mean, that is the logic, right? You first basically have to agree with the orthodoxy, and you have to say, okay, this is I subscribe to these beliefs,
mm-hmm.
and then in this little box that is left, I can talk.
Mm-hmm.
But it is like. You cannot question that,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even the thing saying, you know, that is a political issue is often reason for controversy.
Yeah, yeah.
For many, it's not a political issue. It's like, this is a way and you're kind of ignoring it. You know what I mean? Let's say the Coinbase thing, like the whole thing, like okay, Black Lives Matter is, for me, is a political issue. You know, it's like, yeah. It's a political issue. Why is Black Lives Matter part of, let's say, source code documentation for Go code? Why do I have a banner there? You know, makes no sense. Or why should Coinbase make a statement about Black Lives Matter?
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's a political issue and you can have different opinions on that. But I think for people pushing for that, it's not a political issue. They're pushing with, okay, this is basically, there's only one correct belief. And if you don't want to utter that belief, then
you're out.
You're out.
Yeah.
And it becomes so important that it has to be uttered everywhere. Like I said, what does it have to do on source code document, like in documentation pages for software projects? And where does it end? You know, will we, you know, now it's like you go there and there's one banner. Will there at some point be 10 banners or 50? You know, do we have, it's like with the cookies now, you know, where you have to agree everywhere. Will you always have like this 50 banners on every web page saying, you know, whatever, you know, Black Lives Matter and save the trees and this and that. And
yeah.
And for me, it's actually really, really distracting.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, I want to look up function API, you know, parameters, and then I'm hit with some political thing. You know, it's like ads, basically, in that context for me, you know.
Well, funny that you say that, because I think they are ads. It's the thing is on the website to communicate that whoever is operating the website belongs into the right group and into the socially accepted group. And hence, because it does, it has a future. Because so the interesting thing with what is happening today on a lot of those issues, and it's not just critical race theory and all these things. I mean, let's step away from the actual content. This outside view of what behavior is happening in society is something that has happened a lot of time in history already. And it's always times that we look back to and say, this is really bad, bad times. I mean, the Inquisition is a good example for that, because the height of the Inquisition happens in the context of the early Reformation, where there's a new thing coming up, and then the old thing is defending against the new thing. Or when you look at the beginnings of the Soviet Union, you have the same thing. You have this, everybody has to proclaim communism, or otherwise you're ending up in a gulag, because there was this new thing that needed to have social dominance. And this push for social dominance of certain opinions is there's a thing where that is connected to, and that makes it so difficult and dangerous, and that it is a change of how society itself values things. It's changing the sorting function of who is good and who is bad. And that usually happens not because some random event, but it happens because there's a replacement of elites in society. There's an upcoming generation of wannabe elites, and they want to replace the current elites. Or there's a block of elites that wants to defend against their positions disappearing. So there's this whole field of elite theory, actually, that considers society not so much as you have individuals that are all the same, but, you know, that's the pluralist outlook that you have in a lot of Western society. But in reality, that society is mostly controlled by a thing that we call elites. They are the ones that shape the rules. They're the ones that have most influence in societal decisions. And you have these extreme polarization events, usually during changes of who those elites are. Usually elites are replaced by just younger people ending up in their spots. And that means that to be part of the elites, you have to accomplish certain things, in the sense of you have to accomplish things that the elites value, and then you become part of the elites.
So you kind of go through the normal process, raising through the ranks, right?
Yeah, it's not necessarily raising through the ranks, because elite doesn't necessarily mean that there's a hierarchical structure below it. It more means a milieu. So the society in most Western countries 30, 40 years ago would value political connections and economic power. So those are the classic factors of the elites in like 20, 30 years ago. Before that, the elites would also be defined by religious position or academic position or similar. There were these days when a teacher would almost not be paid, you know, like the standard teacher in the countryside, they would have very little income, but they were highly respected in society because they were the teacher or the priests of the village or the priest of the village would be highly respected because of his position. And that has kind of slimmed down a little bit since the Second World War, where, for example, religious position basically has no correlation to or is not valued by the elites anymore. It doesn't really matter. You can be a cardinal, that doesn't give you any more power than the next door salesman, because it's not a value system that is important for society anymore.
But what I meant was, like, staying with your example, economic power or political connections defined elites. So if you would, you know, accumulate economic power or build these political connections, you would become part of the elites.
Right, but there's not necessarily a ranking, a ranked hierarchy that you have to travel through, but it's more that you have to accumulate these values to be considered elite by other elites.
Sure, yeah.
And this being accepted as elite would actually give you then the societal power. So because other elites consider you elite, you have influence on the elites and on the decision-making processes, etc. So that basically is the core of elite theory. And what is happening now is that a lot of people don't want to sort elites by the same functions anymore. So this, are you rich, is a thing that certainly is something that a lot of people do not want anymore as a sign of the elites. Now it's more important that you're, for example, known, or that you're controversial, or that you're following a new cultural codex of whatever the current political correctness, identity, culture, etc. is. So it becomes a new sorting function for how we select elites.
But I mean, in a way, it's very smart, right?
It is very smart, yes.
It's like, okay, basically it's like this thing, okay, I'm playing this game, I consider the game rigged, or it's too hard, you know? Mm-hmm. And of course it is harder, depending on, I mean, let's put it that way. It doesn't have the same, hardness level for everybody. You know, of course, you know, if let's say 30 years ago, if I'm born to a family that owns already like a established, you know, medium sized company, and I will inherit it at some point and grow up in that environment, I pretty much inherit an elite position, you know, similarly to how somebody royal 200 years ago would inherit that position, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not the same for everybody, how easy it is to get in that elite position. And so it is a very smart strategy to say, okay, instead of, you know, winning the game by the rules, so to speak, let's change the rules, right?
Exactly.
Let's change the game.
It's the interesting thing, of course, then, is that the rules themselves don't matter that much. And if you have only a very small set of rules, and you have too many people that follow it, then you still have this issue that you don't select elites from that. You know, not everybody can be elite. So in a way, you have to introduce additional rules that less people can follow to actually be able to define who's coming out on the top on that. So who has the most value as an elite. And I think that is another thing that can be seen over the last few years, is that this whole new orthodoxy increases in complexity and actually includes new values that cannot be achieved by everybody.
But it is very similar to religious orthodoxy, right?
Absolutely. That
basically, I mean, you know very more than I do, but from what I could gather is that, and let's say in Orthodox Judaism, you have like way, way more rules than, let's say, in Christianity. You know, mm-hmm. And if you want to follow them, it's basically like a full-time job.
And there are people that cannot follow them. So you cannot, like, depending on what section of Judaism you belong to, or you want to belong to, you cannot, because you might need, for example, a Jewish mother. It's something you cannot select.
Okay.
So you cannot actually make it in that context.
So you're basically not pure by definition.
Exactly, not pure by definition.
Yeah.
And we start to see the same things in current cultural changes.
Yeah.
That you cannot actually rise in the new hierarchy of values anymore if you're male or white, or worst case, you're both male and white. Then per definition, you cannot rise anymore. So these rules, in a way, are perfectly designed for creating a new elite structure, because they cull down the contenders and make sure that only a very select amount of people can actually rise to the top and have this being accepted by other elite status. So the funny thing is, again, it's something you can see in history a lot. You know, it happens every couple of hundred years. And it usually has to do with this fact that the existing elites become calcified. So they don't want to allow new people into their ranks. And because of that, they become, you know, harder on new candidates, so to speak. And then sooner or later, you have this issue that that anybody with ambition for power cannot actually achieve power anymore. And then if you're smart, you construct a new value system, try to make the main hubs in society follow it, and then use that new value system to rise to the top.
Mm.
So, and that is what we're seeing right now. So in a way, it is to a large degree, not exclusively, of course, because there are actual issues, but to a large degree, especially when it comes to very vocal people, it's purely a power struggle.
Yeah, what I'm very concerned about is that I'm afraid at some point, basically, to put it bluntly, the killing will start. Because that is what happens a lot in these situations. When that conflict between old elite and new elite turns violent, then people get killed.
Yeah, so judging from history, that is exactly what is the next step, more or less. Yeah. Unless this time everything is very different. But judging from history, you do have to get rid of the old system. You have to clear it out. You know, speaking with the communists, you have to prevent the counter-revolution. And the only way you can do that is get rid of people that are not very clearly on your side. It's the same thing with, you know, the Spanish Inquisition. You know, how do you stop a beginning reformation? By killing all potential reformers.
Yeah, so basically this showing the signs is the first step. Mm-hmm. No, it's like you got to have your Lenin picture on the wall, and you got to have your banners and your whatever things in your profile correct. And then, because basically that is like, okay, let's sort, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody has to agree where he's standing, and then you can clear it up.
Yeah.
And also this dehumanizing the enemy kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I think it's almost you hear this a lot, you know, how could have this happened? You know, how did people go along with this? And, but I'm afraid we're exactly on the same trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's always like this. You dehumanize the enemy, and then you, at some point, you just kill them all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be it the Jews, or be it like the capitalists, or be it like whatever, the white male oppressors. You know, first you have to dehumanize them, and then you can kill them all. And then when it's finally over, 50 years later, people will be like, oh, how could have this happened? You know, why did they go along with it?
Yeah. From a systems perspective, it's an almost necessary step. I mean, the question is, let's come to the question of, is it today necessary to actually kill people if you want to have a change of system? But in the past, it was a necessity. Only that would stabilize your system. Because these changes of rules would only become permanent if you get rid of all those people that don't agree with them. It's the same thing in science. You know, theories usually are belief when everybody who's against them has died or at least lost their position at universities. So this is...
Kuhn, structure of scientific revolution.
Exactly. So... the question I have a little bit is that maybe it is not necessary today. It's necessary in a sense that you prevent previous elites and their supporters from regaining power. That is true. You have to do that. And you have to finalize the cultural revolution in some sense. But I think that maybe today that is not necessary anymore. It's like you don't have to physically kill people.
Why? You just marginalize them economically?
Well, you disconnect them from all systems of society. So today, everybody in society is so much dependent on relatively central hubs to be able to function in society. So, for example, you need a bank account,
mm-hmm.
practically. You need a passport, practically. You need internet access, practically. So there are a lot of these things that you have today that make you function in society. And if the new elites can gain control over those central functions and exclude you from them, then you're not a real risk anymore. You know, you're not going to start a revolution without internet access, a place to live, and a bank account.
Mm.
You're not a threat anymore. You know, who's listening to the ramblings of a bum? Usually nobody. So in a way, canceling out everybody from participating in public life and financial life, etc., might be the way to not having to directly kill people. And it's not without precedent. So in the past, the sortition for who's with the new elites and who's against it was often done by changing land ownership. So, for example, if the kingdom became Catholic, then the land of the Protestants would fall to the Catholics, or vice versa. So it's this disconnecting people from being able to participate fully in society has been used for the same purpose in the past. And I think today it's even easier to do that. I mean, we're in a time where your voice can mostly be suppressed by just kicking you out of a couple of websites, basically.
Okay, so basically, I mean, I have to correct my earlier thing. It's not just the killing. It's also basically you basically put people, let's say, in labor camps. Also what communism did, right?
A time-tested working function, working solution for the problem.
So that would basically be the virtualized labor camp or camp where you disconnect people. And like you said, it's already... it's very easy and it's already happening. But I have the feeling that it is kind of like accelerating the whole process. Well, I mean, it's what you can already see, you know, let's say, you take mainstream social media and, it follows a certain narrative, let's say, and then there are already like a ton of people who basically fall out of that, you know? So it's like, okay, the COVID deniers, let's say, they're not gonna publish videos on YouTube, you know? The Nazis. True. They're gonna get kicked out of, you know, YouTube and Twitter and Facebook and whatever. And however you define those terms, but these are already pretty large groups that got kicked off those platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, I mean, to some extent, they're lacking the tech, but they are already gathering somewhere else. You know, they're like, whatever, Telegram channels with 100,000 subscribers for, you know, people who get banned on the mainstream media sites, which is kind of, yeah, like I said, accelerating this process and kind of like even making it clear, like there are these two groups,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's one side or the other. It didn't get to a position that they are completely marginalized. Of course, if the, let's say, mainstream, the winning side gets so much power that they are able to really completely marginalize people from the other camp, then it's a different situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you, let's say, you have the wrong opinion, you lose your job, you lose your bank account, you lose your ability to travel. Even if they don't kill you and don't put you in a labor camp, you're pretty much, I mean, you're busy just trying to survive.
Yeah. I mean, we see exactly that happening. You know, that's happening. So I think a better term for that is making people disappear from being part of the public. You basically don't want to see anybody anymore who doesn't fit with the new rules. You know, just make them disappear. And if we don't see them, the problem is gone. And I think it's actually an interesting thing that's happening there, because we see that on so many levels. We don't see that only on, you know, can you use the internet or banking or whatever if you're not adhering to the progressive rules of the day. But it's also used by states between themselves. You know, it's this, we don't like a certain state, hence we sanction them. They can't enter in the country anymore. They cannot participate in the financial system anymore. We block their trade, etc. So this more or less extrajudicial concept of just sanctioning people to non-existence has basically become part everywhere. So it's between states, it's between industries, it's between individuals, it's in the platforms and network hubs, etc. So in all this, it's just political. So sanctions are just political. You know, there's no actual judge. There's no written down code. There's nothing like that. So it's just a political expression of power directly.
Yeah, I sent you this picture yesterday, right? About, I think it was 64 or along those lines. Number of countries where Sputnik is approved, approved vaccine. And when you look at that list where it is approved, then it's very clear, at least to me, it looks like very clear that this is like a political block.
Yes.
It's not a random process. You know, it's basically what we discussed earlier about the, in the beginning of the podcast about, you know, how it should look like if it is if it's actually every country looking at Sputnik objectively and deciding is it a good vaccine or not. It would look completely different.
Yes.
And this is super, super clustered around a political block, and which is, I find, really scary, because it shows you that it's not about the facts, and it's not about, I don't know what the facts are. You know, I'm just observing that this is highly clustered, and it cannot be like accident that it's like this.
Yeah, that is, it shows you that it's not about human life at all. It's just about power.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have the same thing when it comes to sanctions. We have the same thing in societal rules. All those rules are not about people. That is what everybody claims. But if you look into it in detail, it has nothing to do with that. It's just about power. And everybody is just trying to execute and stabilize their power. That's all they do by now.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to the predisposition. I have this predisposition that I then, if I realize this, I want to go to the other side and take a look there. You know what I mean? Because I'm basically now in the West block.
Yeah.
Right. And then I'm like, oh, I really want to check out the other side, you know?
If everybody hates them, they have to do something right, you mean?
No, I mean, just because I still want to understand the truth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if I have the feeling I'm being put into this filter bubble, I want to hear the other side. You know? Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that they are right. They probably do the same shit, of course, you know?
Most just certainly, yeah.
Reverse, but I still want to hear the other side.
Yeah.
It's like if I would have been living in East Germany back in the days, I also would have wanted to listen to the West TV, you know, like some people did or a lot of people did. So, and it's a similar thing, you know, and I think we kind of have this, in a way, we live in this age where we have the impression that we're so connected and, you know, we have all the information available, but practically it's not the case.
Yeah.
I mean, like, although theoretically I could look up a lot of things, it's not happening. It's practically, you know, it's like, let's say I would have to, also I would have to speak Russian and Chinese ideally, you know, and then try to really tap into their media systems and their social networks and understand their culture and to really see the other side, you know?
Yeah, there's this nice quote, I can't remember whom it is from, that in the modern day with internet and everything, all the information is available, but the knowledge is lacking.
Yeah.
So we can look up everything, but we understand so much less. So I think that is a good example of that.
And I really do think it's heavily language influenced.
For sure.
It's like the information is simply not there in the languages.
Plus it might not be as well ranked. You know, if you come back to, you know, this rules and that a lot of these things are not just randomly happening, but they're selectively done. And you look at how, you know, search on the internet works, etc., then of course that is reflected there as well. I mean, you can't just go on the internet. You have to find something on the internet. And this finding is itself influenced by what your society, or at least the search engine provider, ranks as being relevant or not. So, and that is, in a way, that is actually a self-reinforcing system. So if you only find relevant things, then you will only quote relevant things that make those relevant things more relevant. And then in the end, you are actually ending up in a local maximum.
Mm.
So it's, yes, you can be most conformant, but you cannot be most right or wise or knowledgeable. That doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. And I think you would have to, it's not about, like you said, accessing the information. I think you actually have to learn how to access the information for the other culture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an example, I would have to go to Russia and learn Russian and, you know, talk to Russians and learn from them. Okay, what search engines do you know use? How do you access information? You know, it's like, or same in China. You know, it's not like the Chinese believe Chinese state media.
No, they don't.
You know, they know that it's propaganda. But of course, they have their ways of accessing information, exchanging it. And it's not like I could replicate that easily going on Google.
Yeah.
You know, I would have to learn these things, basically learn this new cultural context.
You can always search on Yandex. It's not a problem.
Yes. But you know what I mean, right?
I do.
And all these things are like changing quickly, and not just across cultures, but of course also in cultures.
Yeah.
You know.
Concerning the Chinese and believing propaganda, it's this common opinion in Russian and Eastern European countries is that, yes, we know that media is propaganda. And that differentiates us from the West, because in the West, everybody believes that their media is not propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
So in Eastern Europe, people just don't take media or government statements at face value. They know that it's always a little bit wrong and intentionally wrong. You know, there is mm-hmm. propaganda. And in the West, we actually believe that everybody is constantly truthful and unbiased. And that is, if you think about it, it's actually really funny to believe that those same processes of power wouldn't happen in the West. You know, that's stupid. They have always existed. Yeah. And for some reason, we have believed the propaganda that there is no propaganda.
Yeah, there's also this effect I find this really interesting here in Switzerland. So basically, like when you look at newspapers in Germany, there's always a lot of stuff about the U.S. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, when there's U.S. election, it's dominating everything, and it's kind of like normal, and probably because, you know, it's like the important power block.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as easy to see, like I said, when you're inside it. Now I'm here in Switzerland, and then you go on, you know, like Neue Zürcher Zeitung, you know, the biggest Swiss newspaper. You go on their website, and in German, but it's a lot of stuff about Germany.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, why the fuck do they care? You know, but it's probably the same situation, that it's like the big country having a lot of influence over them.
Yeah.
And also the same language, direct neighbor. But it's almost like looking at from the outside, that doesn't really make sense to me, you know, because, okay, why? I mean, it seems almost over-concerned, you know?
Yes.
You know, for me, it's like guys, you know?
Don't care about Germany as much.
Yeah, you should realize a lot of us are leaving, come to you, because you're not driving it, you know, into the ground as quickly. So, you know, don't focus on Germany, you know?
Yeah.
Focus on your own stuff. What is actually working well, you know?
And the question of the relevance is always... So, for example, I often have this issue of not understanding why U.S. news is relevant for me. I haven't been in the U.S. for a lot of years by now. And what do I care if in Chicago there's a car crash? You know, I don't care. I haven't been there for, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years. So why should that be in a Berlin newspaper? I really don't understand that. But I think it has a lot to do with this. Media today is far more structured on this. You follow you're not going into the city anymore and watching and reporting, but you're more quoting other media.
Mm-hmm.
Just to mention the book again, Simulation and Simulacra by Baudrillard, has to be read by everybody. But it's this, we're talking more about media than about anything else. And it's the same thing with these cultural values that are changed. They change primarily because media is talking about it all the time. Mm. And now everybody believes that it's important, but in reality, it's media quoting their own circle of elites. It's relevant for them. It's not relevant for the rest of the world, or it has a different relevance for the rest of the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's this feedback loop, milieu communication that really changes things.
Yeah, I was also thinking of the book and that. what we discussed earlier about the enforcement of let's say certain measures, right? It's mm-hmm. There you can really see it that people, I have the impression that they really, it's like almost a lot of people living in this, it's like a virtual reality in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's like, okay, you know, whatever, there are these measures and like what we had, you know, in HCPP, when people ask, how did you come here? Did you let you in? You know, some people had the impression that the borders were, you know, closed down and yeah. it's not possible to drive through to the country. And there was nothing, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's the same now. It's like, yeah, sure. You have to register if you want to enter Germany and, you know, whatever, do a test and all those things. But if you actually drive from Switzerland to Germany, on the German side, there is nobody.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you get an SMS saying you have to quarantine. That's it. There's nobody there. It's like, it's not fenced off. And, but that's not the dominating reality. The dominating reality is what is, you know, happening in the media, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it's often like when you go somewhere else, when you go outside of this bubble, it's like, you realize how dominating it is.
Yeah.
You know? Like I had this in Ukraine a few times when I talked to people and they were just saying some things which are they were like so politically incorrect
mm-hmm.
for you know my Western upbringing, let's say.
And you're already politically incorrect for me most of the time.
And but the I mean, I wouldn't utter them, let's say, here, and not in general, but more importantly, what I found the most interesting was not that they were saying it, but they were completely oblivious to the fact that it is considered absolutely politically incorrect
yes.
in the West. You know, they're just like honest. It's like a bit like children talk sometimes, you know, they say what mm-hmm. they think and it was, no, it's not a critique. It's just like they just said it. And it's like, okay, well, this is something you, even if you believe it in the West, let's put it that way. Even if you believe it, when you say it, and if you do, you know that it is like super politically incorrect.
Yes.
But they didn't know. Which again shows you this, how, you know, created it is in a way in certain areas.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I find kind of interesting is that even though we have those various bubbles, the drivers of those bubbles are often actually not believing it themselves. So, for example, there's this huge hypocrisy in media and opinion making and all that. So I'm not sure if you heard this story, but in France, with all the lockdowns, all politicians were, oh, we have to do lockdowns, etc. At the same time, they had these secret restaurants for themselves where they could party without restrictions.
Yeah, this one politician got photographed, right?
And exactly.
Yeah. It's like 10 people in a room or something, right?
Yes. Also, and then you have, and the same thing happened in the US, the same thing happens in Germany. It's this publicly, you have to espouse a certain opinion and you want everybody to believe it, but you yourself don't care. It's the same thing with the Sputnik V vaccine. It's this, you publicly proclaim that the most important thing is the life and health of the people, but then you really don't want to focus on that. You know, your politics become more important than that.
Mm.
And at worst, you have to publicly say sorry, you know, and then after a while you come back. But it's this, it shows again how a lot of these themes, topics are proclaimed disingenuous by the elites and by the upcoming elites. It's just, well, not just, but to a certain degree, it is just manipulation and a new form of power struggle. They don't really care for the values that much that they program they have.
No, of course not.
And I think that links to another thing. So there's Lord Acton, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think that is clearly visible in a lot of these things. And it basically shows that human character is undermined and maybe not destroyed, but infected by power. And I find this new, everybody has to take part in this power struggle, actually has the same effect on people. Their character gets undermined. And a good example for that I always stumble over is this: people are not able to consider what another person says in a charitable way anymore. We always have to look for what is wrong about that. You know, we have to make that statement wrong. We have to understand it in the worst possible way. And we have to immediately use it to make a judgment on that. We had that in our personal environment in the last few weeks, where people, they wanted to misunderstand what we were saying, like consciously misunderstand, make the worst possible interpretation out of it, to be able to, for them themselves, to differentiate themselves and actually execute power over our decisions and opinions. And I find it actually concerning, because it's one of those effects of enforced orthodoxy, is that you yourself become an inquisitor, and you kind of have to do it to protect yourself. And it destroys people. You know, at the ends of the spectrum, it destroys people.
Yeah, I think that is one of the driving factors of this dehumanization process, right? People often don't, like you said, they don't want to look at it charitable anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's automatically assumed the other person is like evil. Mm-hmm. And they're not trying to look at it from another perspective anymore. You know, and I mean, I could see that in myself earlier, you know, when I, you know, sometimes I would, you know, take certain opinions and say, whatever, let's pick a contentious issue that's, let's say, you know, abortion, mm-hmm. that, you know, I would think, yeah, when I was younger, I was just like taking over the mainstream opinion, saying, yeah, of course it's okay. You know, mm-hmm. of course it's okay. And if you're against it, you're a religious fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
But actually then talking to people, trying to understand also where they're coming from.
Yes.
You know, why, you know, it's not like, it's a bit more than it says in the book for them, usually.
Yes.
You know, and then, okay, then I could way better understand where they're coming from. And it also, you know, changed my perspective in a way.
Yes.
And it is, I think, this is a good example, actually, as an issue. It's a very, very complicated issue. Like the question of abortion, it has many nuances, and it's a very hard problem, you know? And it actually requires to understand the other party, and it also requires to, you know, there are all these corner cases too, you know?
And by now the topic is so problematic that you can't even invest enough time and charity to even learn about that. And it's actually problematic if you do. So, I mean, people look at you wrong if you're trying to understand the other side.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a good example, right? Where this is, again, split into this two camps, right?
Yes.
In the US, at least, it's like this. You're pro-life or you're pro-choice, right? It's
yes, black there's nothing in between.
There's nothing in between. And I mean, all these, you know, like, what about rape? What about if the child is, you know, disabled, you know, has some health problems? What about if the mother has health problems? You know, what time, you know, the philosophical implications, when does life start and all of that, you know. No, it's literally, forget about all of this. It's one or the other.
Yes.
And if you're on side A, then the people from side B, they're completely nutcases and evil.
Yes, exactly. And vice versa.
Yeah. And although it is actually, for me personally, I believe it's an issue where even if you look at it nuanced, I mean, there, in my opinion, there is no like really great answer.
No, it's a situation that sucks and it will always suck.
Exactly.
You know, that's this issue with a lot of those topics is, if it's abortion, if it's feminism, if it's all these things, is this, there's this idea that with the right thought, we somehow can make the world suck, not at all. But there are so many situations where there's simply no path of action that is going to make it suck less. It will always suck.
Yeah.
And no matter what you're telling yourself, it will suck. And it will be hard. And it will be heartbreaking or unfair or all these things. You know, it will be a shit world after all, in a sense. And that's it.
Getting into depressive territories now even more. But
hey, that is what we do on every episode.
Come yes. where's the drink? No, but you're right. I think we all gonna die in the end, right? So that usually sucks. I mean, for most people, that sucks. And I think it's also like the world is inherently unfair.
Yes.
You know, people are not born the same. I mean, sure, you know, everybody has like the same or should have, you know, like theoretically the same rights. But we are not the same. We're not all born the same with the same abilities and things like that. Not the same parents, not the same countries, you know. Some people get shitty illnesses with no fault of their own. Others don't, you know. And
it's the lottery of life.
Yeah, it's a lottery. Illnesses suck, right? So, and the bad ones suck really badly. And, you know, accidents, all that stuff, you know. And
yeah.
Just had it the other day, you know, I almost had an accident and I just got lucky, right?
Yeah.
But it could have been really severe, you know, I could have been, you know, fucked up now. And so in an alternative universe, I probably am, you know, and and you're right. And I think that somehow also gets lost often in the discussion that it's, We can try to make things better and fairer, and you know, we can try to act as humans, but we cannot take the suckiness out of life.
We can't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that will create more suck.
Well, that is exactly the thing. A lot of things that we're trying to do right now is just reducing the suck for some people by increasing the suck for others.
Mm.
That's basically the recipe that we're using everywhere. We're distributing suck. And for some reason that makes it fine. You know, that, and I don't know, it's one of these differences between conservative thought and liberal thought, actually. It's this, conservatives are, they know that it will always suck, and liberals are, we can perfect the world by evenly distributing suck or whatever. So, and I think that nobody is really thinking about how to be able to actually deal with suck. We don't learn that anymore.
Mm.
The smallest thing is suddenly a catastrophe. And
yeah,
that is, I don't know. I kind of think we as humans with the state, you know, to use the anarchist mantra here a little bit, with the state, we have actually become dramatically worse in dealing with suck.
Mm. Yeah, sometimes you just have to suck it up.
Yeah, not necessarily suck it up, but at least don't make other people suffer just because you threw the wrong ticket in the lottery. You know, it's one thing to help each other and to try to participate in the suck of others, you know, out of charity. That's a good thing because it actually helps all people.
Mm.
But if your solution for suck is to just distribute suck, you're not making a more optimal world.
Mm.
So, yeah.
I just had this funny thought that basically suck is a bit like the inverse of fucks. So,
yes, it is.
You know the saying, right? There are like only so many fucks you can give.
Yeah.
So make them count, choose the right fucks you give. And with suck, there's a minimum amount of suck that is always there. And it's just a matter of how it's distributed. And often when we try to make it fairer, we increase the overall level of suckness.
The total amount of suck increases.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're creating, real problems, you know.
Yeah. And the real problem is to stay with those two words that describe complex metaphysical realities is if you have enough suck in your life and other people put more and more suck on you, sooner or later you will stop to give a fuck about them and their sucks.
Yeah, that's what's probably driving this polarization.
Yeah. Well then, now I'm depressed.
As always.
So to recap the whole thing, everybody is competing about power. We are becoming uncharitable hypocrites. We don't give a fuck about that because everything sucks anyways.
So
hashtag no future. Okay, now we should turn it around. Let's not stop on the dark note. Because I think there are important things we can do to make things better or at least prevent them from becoming so much worse. I mean, after all, this is called Cypherpunk Bitstream and we're talking about crypto anarchy. And
we're turning it around here.
We're turning it around. So I think when you begin to understand how the corruption by power, through power, and with power is spreading everywhere, and how it is minimizing thought, and how it is minimizing charity, and all these things, and how it is using these networks of controls, those hubs of control, the necessity to have permission, the social media mobs, and all these things. If you look at all these things, I think that crypto-anarchist thought actually has something to contribute there. Because in a world where crypto-anarchist systems are bigger, a lot of these avenues of power don't work. So if you're able to communicate anonymously and encrypted, you still can have conversations and explore thought without having to have that fear of ending up on the wrong side of the shooting squad. So, and that is not just a thing that happens in the real bad countries, but it would contribute to the ability to continue to think for yourself everywhere.
Mm.
So I think that is an important thing to keep in mind. And the other important thing is when we're talking about disconnecting people from their ability to participate in life, I think that reinforces this idea that what we really need is anonymous and permissionless systems that allow us to participate in economic transactions, allow us ownership and control over things, and help us participate in the legal structure. So you cannot be cancelled from using an untraceable, anonymous, permissionless currency. It cannot be used as a sanction against you.
Mm.
And that shows how a lot of these tools that today a lot of people are working on and thinking about are really necessities if you don't want to create a system on the other side that is ripe for being taken over by a new elite every few years and then shooting squads and sanctions coming along. So I think it reinforces why those systems and those ideas are really important, because otherwise we're ending up in a world of conformity towards whatever the most power connected opinion is. And monocultures of thoughts cannot help humanity to progress. You know, I mean, I know that you want to go to the stars together with Elon Musk. And for me, it's just enough that people interact with each other as human beings and as individuals. You know, my standards are very low. You know, I mean, I actually believe that humans on this planet would have a chance if they would take power out of the systems of life.
No, I totally agree with this. It's the Musk question is a different one. It's just about not putting all your eggs in one basket.
True.
But I still believe this is the better habitat. So, I mean, it's a very important point, your points you raised there. And I think that is the important thing about these crypto-anarchy ideas and visions, is that it builds these alternatives, you know, on top of each other. There can be multiple systems in the same geographic location.
Mm-hmm.
And without always having to compete over the power in that physical space. And I mean, maybe it's just some bias I have, but I see it a lot of in, like, let's say, libertarians, and I have it a lot. I had it a lot myself, and I just moved away. I experienced it as that. Like, for the freedom-minded people, there's always a lot of thought about, okay, where's the golden country, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, where are the zero taxes and the freedom and all of that? And I think the important thing there is really to realize that it doesn't exist. You know, like, the perfect country doesn't exist, and we kind of have to... And we're not going to create it by taking over power somewhere and making it into this, you know, promised land. I mean, there are better countries and there are worse countries, but ultimately it is about creating these alternatives.
Yeah, it's these alternatives that actually have less potential for power. So there's less power to be had in the system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we shall continue working on that.
That'd be good. Yeah, then we should wrap it up. Do we actually have any questions?
We have suggestions for future episodes, but we have to prepare more for them. But we don't have any questions I'm aware of.
Okay, cool. Then let's just wrap up with the donation report as usual. So, first of all, thank you very much for your support and your donations. This is really helpful and encouraging. And as usual, we report the donations in the currency that had the most donations. So this time it is Zcash that won. So we got one Zcash in Zcash, and we got 0.9 Zcash in Bitcoin and 0.32 Zcash in NEAR. And 0.1 Zcash and Bitcoin Cash. Thanks again. And as always, if you want to give us some feedback, please send us an email to bitstream@taz0.org. And you can also send us postal mail. You find the address on taz0.org. And there's also a forum on bbs.nrplex.net. And all of these info and all of the donation addresses, you can also find on the website taz0.org. And yeah, thank you very much for listening. Hope to, it wasn't too depressing and we could give you some good info.
There was a positive outlook at the end.
Yeah, it's always a positive outlook.
And also, if you can rate and review us on your podcast app and platform, etc. So, because there's no correlation between the amount of listeners we have and the view that we have on those platforms. So, if you can rate us nicely and leave a constructive review, we will be very happy, and it will help other people to find Cypherpunk Bitstream. And thank you for listening.
That's a very good point. Yeah, we actually never mentioned that ever, I think.
Yes, we have to learn.
We're marketing geniuses.
Yes. So anyway, I hope the next episode won't be in 4 months, but sooner, but we'll see.
We try our best. We still have the road trip episode planned at some point. So,
yeah, don't hold your breath. But thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.